Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. This week's show is a combination of an encore interview with veteran frame builder Ben Cerrata and a short personal wrap-up of Interbike. The show is in podcast form only this evening, but I'll be back with a complete wrap-up of Interbike, my show interviews, and some other news next week at the usual time. With a new venue, a consumer day, and some of the hottest weather on record, there were some things to overcome. But all in all, I think Interbike 2013 was a success. Brian and I touched down in Vegas late Monday night. We wanted to be there so that we could attend some presentations as well as go to the Bootleg Canyon for demo days on Tuesday. The presentations are usually targeted to bike dealers. We attended one given by a personal friend who's a pricing specialist. It was very interesting. It was fun watching him do his thing. And I even learned a thing or two. It really is such a hot topic among bicycle dealers about how to compete with the internet, with Amazon.com, and some of the other big players on the retail market. I think this was pretty timely. I think Mark's presentation was excellent. So demo day, or as it used to be called, dirt demo, was awful. The venue is about 30 minutes from downtown Las Vegas. The wind was blowing at 40 to 50 miles per hour. It was 99 degrees. And within 2 minutes, I was pretty much covered head to toe in the fine sandy dirt that characterizes the landscape. The conditions didn't seem to deter folks, though. They were testing out bikes and didn't seem to be deterred at all by the wind and the dirt. But I found it almost unbearable. Guess I'm just getting spoiled and old. We only stayed long enough to make one lap of most of the vendors. And truthfully, I didn't see a lot of new stuff out there. Mandalay Bay, though, which is the home of Interbike for the next several years, is a much bigger convention hall than the Sands, and all the exhibits were on one floor. As a member of the press, I actually got to move through the exhibit hall as things were being set up on Tuesday. If you've never seen a convention being set up, it's pretty interesting, and you wonder how they're going to be ready for the next morning. But they were. As technology continues to improve, registration has become much more streamlined and efficient. A simple touch screen where you typed in the first letter of your first name and then you type in your last name and a badge printed instantly. The people behind the registration booth were very nice. Well, they didn't have a whole lot to do. They put your badge in the appropriate holder, whether you were press or a buyer or a staff member or an exhibitor, and off you went. It only took like 2 seconds. Mandalay Bay does have a few drawbacks, however, including fewer reasonably priced restaurants than the Sands, and of course the fact that the hotel and convention center are at the opposite end of the Las Vegas Strip from a lot of the other major attractions such as the Forum Shops and Bellagio's Dancing Fountains and Treasure Island's little play that they do outside the hotel. That said, though, everyone there at Mandalay Bay was helpful and efficient and seemed to really appreciate having our convention there. The convention floor was laid out and numbered as streets and neighborhoods. So there was a triathlon neighborhood and an e-bike neighborhood, et cetera, et cetera. The only problem, there were a lot of dead-end streets and no signs that said cul-de-sac. It was often difficult to figure out where you were, where you wanted to go. The electronic app that I downloaded to my iPhone, which was supposed to locate me on the convention floor and then help guide me to where I wanted to go, either didn't work right or I didn't know how to work it. But I heard a lot of people say that it was not what they expected it to be. So I wasn't able to use it properly and spent a lot of time wandering around. And actually, it was wasted time in a lot of ways. But they were minor glitches, really. The experience of being around all those people I've known and worked with for over 30 years is exciting and familiar. It's a homecoming of sorts. I was able to talk with several people I've interviewed in the past year, including Juliana Furtado and Brent Steelman. I tried for over 20 minutes to find Richard Schwinn at Waterford and finally gave up, but it was just going to be a hello anyway. So we had two great dinners, one at the Luxor's Public House, which is a little bar and grill. I guess it's not that little, but it's really, really good. Brian had an awesome amber ale called Full Sail that he liked. I had a very nice wine. The food was excellent. The service was excellent. And it was not terribly expensive. The second place we ate was at the Luxor Shops upstairs. The restaurant was called Rice. Obviously, it is Japanese. Again, excellent food and fabulous service. It was a very nice experience being at that part of the Vegas Strip. So next week, you'll hear my interviews with some of the people I always try to check in with at Interbike. I think it lends some continuity to the otherwise chaos that Interbike might be for someone who has never attended. I was unable to stay for Consumer Day, but we'll talk with folks in the upcoming weeks who were there and get some feedback about it. So before we go to the interview with Ben Cerrato, which was the very first show that we broadcast as the Outspoken Cyclist back in September 2010, I'd like to say that I'm hoping to reconnect with Ben in the upcoming weeks as he reinvents himself in the industry. Cerrato Competition Cycles owners, new owners, have renamed their business Saratoga Frameworks, which I am both glad to see and think is appropriate. I believe that Ben will resurface in the not-too-distant future and once again will wow the cycling community with his vision and expertise. So here is my encore interview with Ben Cerrato from 2010. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. I want to have our listeners know a little bit about Cerrato Cycles and where you're from and sort of who you are.
Sure. Well, I'm native of Saratoga Springs, New York, which is where we are still to this day.
Yes, you are, because here I am.
Because here you are. And, my fascination with bicycles started at a very early age, and the story is actually very simple. I grew up enjoying making things and riding bicycles, and had plenty of encouragement from family, either directly or indirectly, in that most of my mother's family are artists for generations. And both sides of my family were workaholics, so that all kind of melded together. And to me, bicycles represented the perfect combination of form and function.
So when you were a youngster, you actually grew up here, you went to school here. Did you go away to college?
Briefly,
okay.
Yes.
Me too.
I, as a child of the 60s, and I was in high school during the 60s, and when the environmental movement was just taking off, and I was determined to change the world.
In
a different way than I originally planned. I had started this bike shop as an offshoot of my family's, my parents' business. It was sort of a general store in town called the Farmer's Hardware that sold everything from hardware to imported fabrics and art supplies and especially nice gardening tools. And when I was in my mid-teens, I convinced my parents that that bicycles might fit in there well. And I think they thought that, well, you know, here's our kid has this kind of idea and a focus, and maybe it's not a bad idea. There's something that we know where he'll be.
Well, that's true. You weren't out running the streets.
And so we started selling bicycles and repairing bikes as a branch of my folks' store. In school, I had hoped that I'd become an environmental biologist. That was my plan. That I'd go to college and seek that path to help change the world. Between high school and college, I worked for a small time at a little custom shop in southeast London called Whitcomb Lightweights. And it was an incredibly romantic experience.
That would be London, England.
London, England,
okay.
That's right. And it was a very romantic experience. I turned 18 while I was there. I was was going out at night and drinking lager and eating fish and chips and playing billiards and working in this tiny little bike shop, learning how to make custom quality bicycles. And then I came back went off to college and just couldn't get my head into it. So I took a leave of absence after about a year. I felt that there was something I just had to finish up on this bicycle thing. And I really thought that probably after another year or two, I'd go back to college.
Ha ha. Exactly. And finish up this bicycle thing, huh? So were you ever a competitive or long distance rider?
Well, somewhat. I did a lot of cycle touring, my parents, fortunately, were very trusting and permissive. I suppose today they might be arrested for the same, but I used to go on multiple day bike trips from the time I was, I think, 12-ish.
By yourself?
Always with a friend,
okay.
But no adults. And we'd go bike touring, packing everything that we needed on our bicycles and just heading off into New England. And so I did a lot of cycle touring. And then I did a very little bit of competitive cycling. Unfortunately, at the time, I was a teenager and shortly after that, there was very little racing in this area. And so I actually got involved in putting on bike races and promoting bike races. Eventually became an official for the Cycling Federation for a period of time. And my days were so full between organizing races and running a bike shop that that's the sad thing, there just wasn't enough time to ride enough to be competitive. So fortunately, most of, I think, our customers today aren't as cautious isn't the word, but to me, I didn't really want to race if I felt that I was going to have too many excuses as to why I didn't do that well, like not training enough.
Right.
But there are a lot of athletes today who the joy of competition is enough, and however fit they are there, that's
And I see that. I think that's kind of an interesting point that you just jump in wherever you are.
That's right.
Fit-wise, and hope that you don't go home and be in bed for 3 days
because that's right.
You
exactly.
did more than you could.
Yeah.
So you went from running this little bike shop. So I assume you had production bikes at that time?
Yeah,
you weren't making bikes.
No,
at that time.
Yeah. Well, we actually started the shop. I was 14 at the time, and we were selling Peugeots. And
PX10Es
and UO8s, and we also sold Lejeune, another French brand that you don't hear of anymore.
No, that's
and,
true.
Bottecchia and Atala, and
so you were the Stuyvesant in the Saratoga Springs.
Yes,
area. Remember
Stuyvesant
them?
North,
remember
yes.
Stuyvesant?
And so it was a fun time because we really had no idea that a bike boom was about to start on the East Coast. There was a bike boom that had begun on the West Coast in the late 60s and made its way east.
Everything takes 10 years,
yes.
We decided.
And so we had this little shop, and it was myself and another one or two friends from high school and a fellow who was a few years older. And we just had a blast because people just started coming in to buy bicycles and have their bikes repaired. And we worked hard and played hard, and it was good fun.
So at some point, you made the decision you wanted to learn how to build bicycles.
Right. It was as I was finishing high school, preparing for this serious pursuit of environmental science. I thought that the one thing that I needed to do to just kind of complete my bike phase was to learn how to build them. And so that was the
okay,
fatal
then.
Mistake. Actually, not so.
No.
I've been very happy with my. I have no regrets. So I had this 6 month period between I graduated high school a little bit early and had some time to kill. So I wrote a number of shops in England, and
because Whitman I knew the language, sent their hands up,
and Whitcomb was the first to respond, and I went there. It worked. It was a phenomenal experience.
So you learned at that point to build steel frames. That's what they were building.
Right.
In
that's
those days.
Really. Yeah. The only bikes of any real quality in the 60s and 70s and actually in the 80s were steel bicycles.
So we're going to come forward now and decide how you left. So whatever happened, let me ask one question that I didn't think of until now, and that is, what happened to your parents' wonderful store, which I wish I'd grown up in listening about?
Well, you would have enjoyed it.
I would have.
They sold the store, it's probably 25 years ago now.
Yeah.
And but at Saratoga, the Saratoga that I grew up in was a town of about 15,000 people at that time. And their store was the only place north of New York City or south of Montreal or west of Boston where you could buy fine cooking ware. So their concept for the store was if they saw something and liked it, they'd buy two.
One for themselves and one to sell.
Well, or maybe three. One for themselves, one and two for the shelf. And if one sold, they'd buy another.
Right.
That's
the retail concept that works.
And
one to show, one to go.
That's right.
Right, okay.
And so it was, but it was it was before this region developed in a retail sense. And so it really was a destination location. They had customers that came from quite a ways to buy unusual things.
And so the bike shop itself, you'd already moved forward 25 years ago, they were still doing that. You were already doing something different.
Yeah, in 1978, so I started building frames more or less. It was 1972 when I went to England
okay.
a little bit. And then on returning from college, taking my leave, not too long after that, I met Marcy, who's my wife.
And where did you meet her?
She was a Skidmore College student. We clicked, and so she became involved with the business at a very early stage there, and we were trying to run this retail business, and I had it in my head that I wanted to build a few more frames just to see what would happen.
Right.
And so it was a few years of sort of balancing these two things. In 1978, we decided to sell the retail store because we just couldn't do everything well.
Really?
Yeah. And then went into bike building full time.
And I saw the factory before this one in Glens Falls. Is that where your first factory was?
No, actually the first factory was right in Saratoga Springs in the building that we had the bike shop in. It was a little building. And it was very, very quaint. The bike shop was on the first and second floor, and the frame building shop was on the third floor, and very primitive conditions. But it was as close to the English experience as you could get, because it was cold and dank, and tools were primitive. But they built bikes on that stood on craftsmanship. Rather than anything technical.
Yeah, because I remember this story about this cold, dank, that's the life of the apprentice frame builder. And I do remember that. I think I heard you tell the story at one of the NAHBS shows.
Well, it really fits with the starving artist theme.
Yes.
and it really was part of the romance working in England, because everyone who was working there was working there for the love of the craft. No one was really making any money, but you lived to build these fantastic machines, and with the aid of very few tools. So the English frame building in the 60s and 70s anywhere in the world was was far more reliant on pure craftsmanship than it is today. Over the last 20 years, many tools have been developed that are conventional, and there are a few companies that make tools that make it significantly easier to build straight bicycles, for example.
Right. And as opposed to going back to the frame table 500 times.
Or not because you don't have one.
Yeah. Worse yet.
And so it was a different era of building bikes.
So that's how Cerato Cycles started.
We just decided to go for it. So we had this little shop in Saratoga Springs, and then in 1978, when we made the split from the bike shop, we bought an old farm not far from here, about 10 miles out of town, and the whole place needed work. But we were very young and very energetic, and so we renovated the house. So it was a 200-year-old farmhouse, and the barn became the workshop, and the chicken coop became the paint shop.
Any feathers in the paint? Just kidding.
Yeah, well, we kept them out of the paint, but there were still feathers in the building.
Well, at least maybe you had fresh eggs.
That's right.
Right. So now your company is large, but not mammoth. So you didn't grow into a Giant or a Trek or a Specialized. I mean, Trek kind of started out on the same path that you did. And then they went on this huge production path. I mean, I can remember years and years and years when they first were around, these steel, kind of lug, pretty little muted color frames. But you took this road down this custom, I mean, I would call you a custom builder. That is what you are. That is who you are. You work through independent bike shops. You only have about 100 dealers. I was talking to Stan earlier, and he said you have about 100 dealers. That's been pretty consistent throughout your... I mean, I know there's been incarnations of things that have changed for you over the years, but everything seems pretty stable right now for you.
Yeah, well, you know, the plan never was to become the next large bike company. And the decision process in terms of making peace with not becoming the environmental biologist was really maintaining a family attitude, which is whatever you're going to decide to put your main efforts behind, make sure that you're doing something that's, if possible, extraordinary. There's really no need to... The world never needed another bike company.
Got it. Yes, I agree.
And they're in the 70s and today. There are plenty of companies who make high quality bicycles of every category, and so being in the business for sake of being in the business is not what motivates me, or has motivated me. But trying to bring something better, raising the bar, is what keeps the business interesting. That's always been its focus. And so being bigger has... I would have never objected to more growth than we've had. But in many ways, our focus on moving the bar in terms of whether it's quality or technology or the whole fit story, those things have taken our focus and energy, and we just follow... Our growth kind of follows behind that.
So in case you're just joining us, you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist on WJCU FM 88.7. And we are speaking with Ben Cerata from Cerata Cycles in Saratoga Springs, New York. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with my interview with Ben Cerata.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Oh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist with the remainder of our interview with Ben Cerata.
So how do you qualify somebody to become a strata dealer or to sell your frames? Well, I mean, I understand it because, of course, that's what Hubbub does.
So. Well, that's a great question, and that's changed somewhat over the years. And we've actually become increasingly persnickety, I guess you could say.
About, I think it's a good word.
About who represents us. Is the way that I look at it, I try to see it from a consumer's perspective, and that our bicycles delivered through any bike shop are still going to be a very fine bicycle. But there is so much personalization in the process that we can deliver from tuning the ride, really have fine-tuned the process of fine-tuning the ride to an individual, not just from fit, but in terms of overall function. A store that doesn't understand our product line can't possibly deliver the full value to the consumer. So we want every customer who buys one of our bicycles to have an incredible experience. And because we really look for dealer relationships that we can work as close partners. It's a team.
Right.
And so that starts to eliminate. So we look for dealers who really have similar ideals to ours, that they're committed to providing this absolutely fantastic cycling experience to the customer, which goes beyond just having the customer leave the bike shop the first time with a smile on their face because they like the color of the bike.
Right. Yeah. Or can you stand over this bike?
That's right.
It fits you very well. Very nice.
So we have established requirements in terms of dealers' training level in terms of bike fit, and they have to have a more than adequate understanding of our product range. And that's it. The amount of volume that we do is not so. It's not so much a part of the early conversations. If the relationship is right and the shop is right, the volume just follows that.
Yes, I understand that. So you have approximately 100 bike dealers around the country. You also sell bikes sometimes direct to consumers. Can a consumer come to Cerata and get fit and then sized and then have a frame built?
Yes, that's something that's relatively recent in the last couple of years. For as long as we've been doing this, we started doing business dealer direct. I started out in the retail business,
right.
And then we went dealer only in 1978. And we spent a lot of time over those years telling people, no, you can't come here. No, you can't buy a bicycle here. And we realized, well, we have this, I believe, an incredible setting here. We have a wonderful building, wonderful business, wonderful people.
It's a great facility, and it's got a lot of opportunity here.
And so we have this asset, and it's pretty silly for us to not let our customers be exposed to that. So, and this is also used as a training facility for dealers, or to actually in our classes that we teach these days, not only do people who work for bike shops come, but we have physical therapists and coaches and personal trainers who are coming to learn about bike fitting. In any case, the theme is we want our customers to have the best possible experience and the experience they like. Quite a few of the people that are coming to have advice to visit the factory, they'll just visit the factory, get excited, and go back
and order a bike from
their bike shop.
Sure.
Some people will come here and have a fitting and have the bike delivered at their home bike shop. So the concept is not to go into competition with our dealers. We have we work very closely to support the dealers who do an outstanding job. But we want to be available. So the idea is to let our customers buy the bike in the way that works best for them.
So do you have dealers who do their own designs?
Yeah, the dealers that we have dealers that we've done
That's
lot
a personal
of
question.
Yeah, we have dealers who we've done a lot of business with for a long time and who understand our process and are well enough that They'll do a fitting, and they'll do
a drawing,
an initial template, design template. And of course, we always review that. And suggest revisions and so forth. But it's the next best thing to being there is having a dealer who understands what they're, so they've done a fitting, great, and but they want to be able to communicate with the client kind of what the expectations are.
So that leads me into the next area that I'd like to talk about, and that is, where is the bicycle industry going? It seems to be going in maybe a couple of directions, and what's going to happen? There are fewer bike shops now by over 1,000 or almost maybe even more since I started in the business. And without the support of the servicing end of bicycling, these bicycles do not service themselves.
No, they don't.
And they need help. I mean, we still build all our own wheels, for example. Mm-hmm. So where is it going, and how are these bike shops going to maintain their edge, their sharpness? And I think part of it is custom, to me.
Yeah, well, it's service. I think for the most part, most consumers, I think most people in the industry don't really understand what custom is. Custom is a broad word.
It is a broad word.
So while bespoke sounds stuffy, that's closer to what we do and what you offer at your business, which is the bike is designed from the ground up, every aspect of it.
Right.
Whereas a lot of people have in their mind eye, custom is. Trek sells custom bikes. You
sure.
can order a bike and change the components and choose a wide range of finishes. And so, but those are customized stock bikes.
Right.
And we're building bikes to order from the ground up.
So we describe it as we build the bike around you, as opposed to fitting you onto something that already exists.
That's a great way of putting it. The challenge is that, as I said, the perception is varied. Most consumers don't really understand the difference, and most people working in the bike industry don't really understand what we do either. And those feelings are influenced largely by the efforts of the major bike companies are building, by and large, much better bicycles than they were 10 years ago.
Yes, I would agree.
And they also have changed how the industry functions. There are fewer bike shops, or there are fewer owners of bike shops, and major companies. It's a turf war, specialized in Trek leading the way, but Giant and Cannondale not far behind, and a bunch of other companies who are all fighting for dominance at the point of retail. And so
you mean your concept stores, those kinds of things.
The concept stores, or even if it's not a concept store, the percentage of commitment to a branded product in a store, and they provide all kinds of elaborate marketing support.
And you buy so many categories and peripherals,
and financial support as well. So that's changed the complexion of bike shops. So where I see the future, at least the future for us, and I think for consumers in general, is there'll really be two categories of shops. We cover everything as long as it's Trek or specialized bike shop, and they're good, because those companies, to their credit, are investing in the dealerships, because they want their concept stores to provide exceptional service. So it's not a bad thing. So those stores are going to be predictably good places to go.
And they become feeder stores sometimes for people like you and me.
Who want to have something. We're the businesses that offer consumers something different, a different experience, because it's more personal and a higher quality experience. I think that what only time will tell is what percentage of the cycling population decides that they'd like to invest the time and money to do something that's special. And I'm actually quite optimistic. The last couple of years have been a little bit rough going, and there's been an abundance of excess product in the marketplace. And
yeah, but it's shaking out.
It's shaking out now.
I agree. So, having said that, and because we're going to probably run out of time here, I could talk to you all day, but if you look back over all the years you've been in business, what do you think your biggest success has been?
I'll kind of go back to the frame of mind that I was in when I made the decision of, okay, I'm going to be in the bicycle business, and with the notion that we have to leave something behind that's better, otherwise we didn't need to be here at all. And so I think our efforts in bringing bike fitting to the industry is probably the most significant contribution we've made to cycling. It's not that we were the first company to ever think of bike fitting, but our concept of bike fitting was a real departure, which is everything about our fitting process is takes the cyclist as an individual, and we're not paying, we don't compare each cyclist to a database of 1,000 or 10,000 or 50,000 cyclists.
It's
just the only cyclist that matters is you, the one we're working with at the time. And so I think from concept to developing a teaching process that's now kind of widely mimicked, we really, I think, have made a lasting difference there. So that's probably overall that's the thing that I'm probably most proud of.
Well, tell me about the Cycling Institute. I mean, I don't know that a lot of people know about it. I know about it, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting outgrowth of what you've done, and I think it's really important.
Well, thank you. I had never set out to change bike fitting, but I did set out to build the best bike. I think most bike companies will say that part of their mission statement is building the best bikes in the world.
Yeah, I would say that.
I think that we figured out what that meant, though, and that we can't, if we're going to build the best bicycle in the world, it really is a personal thing. It has to be the best bicycle in the world for you.
Right.
You know? And so I realized back in the late 70s and early 80s that using various fitting methods that were kind of out there being used were just not delivering the best, most consistent results. And so developing this notion of how to fit somebody properly for a bike derived directly from wanting to deliver the best bike. So the motivation was to deliver the best bike. Okay, I guess we have to figure out more about bike fitting. And then I realized that over time, one of the most frequently asked questions that we get from cyclists is, I've been to 3 different bike shops and they each tell me I need something different.
Right.
And so we developed this tool, the SciCycle, which is an infinitely adjustable stationary bike. And
of which I've had one for decades.
And then it took me another 10 years to realize that it was just a tool.
Right.
And unless we, like any tool, it can be a great tool or a bad tool.
Well, you don't know how to use it, exactly.
And so this is where I have to give Michael Sylvester of Portland credit. He was fellow who was using a SciCycle and was relentlessly nagging me about the notion that you really need to teach this because
teaching it. I mean, I've tried to explain it and put it down on paper, and we're very successful at it. But if you can't, you're right. If you can't convey it to somebody else, I get hit by a truck and there goes all my experience.
Exactly.
That's why I'm interested in the Institute, because you seem to be codifying it somehow.
Yeah, so in 1978, we brought together in 2 waves about 20 different regional fitters, people who had developed reputations in their area for doing a great job of fitting bikes. Without pre-qualifying, bringing them in here, how they were doing. But we just put together a think tank. And I had my notion about how to go about bike fit, which was this idea that you're looking at the cyclist and it's about movement, it's not about static measurements.
Right.
But we started culling from everyone's experience and ideas the things that seem to work in to whatever degree anybody understood what working meant, what good bike fit was. Well, if somebody's feeling good and gaining power and strength and comfort, it's probably good.
Probably good. Seems so to be our big three.
The methodology started with my kind of concept of movement and position, but just kind of added to. We started tweaking it from the get-go based on common practice that seemed to be working. And then there, of course, always in the early days, there were a lot of ideas that didn't really hold water. So we kind of demystified or debunked some of the classic drop the pump line from your tip of your nose kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
really?
It was one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's a good one. You know what? I hadn't heard the tip of the nose part, but that's good.
So
I missed that.
The school, we started teaching classes later that year, 1978, but it's, and by now, there have probably been 1,200 or more different students go through the program. And then we approach every class the same way. It's a fairly highly polished program right now and very hands-on. But you never know when somebody's going to leave some little nugget behind.
Right.
Because we're not the only ones in the world that have ever thought about bike fitting. There's a lot of passionate people who have given this a lot of thought. And one of the fun things is, especially in the last several years, we've had an increase in participants from the medical community. And so that's both helped to further tweak and fine-tune and legitimize some of the things that just seem to make sense, but until more recently, not necessarily sure why. And so it's just been a great experience, and it's evolutionary.
So the Institute is actually in Colorado? Or is that where it's headquartered? Is that what it is?
No, it's actually headquartered here.
Oh, but you do a symposium?
It was headquartered in Colorado for a little while. Depends on who is running it.
Oh, got it. Okay.
And we did have the two symposiums that we held. We're both in Colorado, and we took a hiatus. We found when the economy started tanking that suddenly our respondents were, well, I can't participate
right.
this year.
Yeah, I can't fly out this year.
So that's sometime, I'd say, within the next 6 months that we'll get the next one rolling again. Because there were wonderful, great exchanges of
sure.
ideas and so on.
Sure. So I guess we should probably wrap it up by talking about where you think the bike industry is going. Where do you think it's heading in the future, in the United States especially? I mean, I'm doing a lot of advocacy work to try and get things like safe routes to school going and, complete streets and the kinds of things that will get people back on bikes on the entry level. But where do you see it going, maybe from the top down even, as opposed to from the bottom up?
Well, in general, I think that cycling is yet to see its golden age here.
Good. And, I'm glad to hear you say that.
The momentum that in our area here, and I travel the country quite a lot as well, and the participation is definitely on a steady increase. And you see people when you see people with smiles on their faces, that's a good thing. And I think actually the whole fitting piece has helped that bike companies in general are making bicycles that fit people better these days.
Well, I think use the word fit a lot.
Yeah, and so if you're comfortable, you're going to enjoy something more and tell your friends. And so I think that momentum is growing. I don't think it's come close to plateauing. And it's a fantastic sign that communities are... Even today, in these tight economic times, figuring out how pedestrians and cyclists can manage to have safe places in communities, that's continuing. That hasn't stopped. So I think cycling is going to become part of the general fabric of how people move around in this country in a way that we never could have imagined 10 or 15 years ago. So the industry will follow that. It will be healthy.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so. Well, anything left you want to talk about? Just to wrap it up? And this has just been wonderful. It's nice to be able to sit across the table and talk.
We haven't talked in a long time. Long time. We could probably do this for a few hours or so. I start every day with the same level of enthusiasm that I did back when I made a commitment in the late 70s.
See, so, that's very cool because you go to work every day and love what you do like I do.
I feel fortunate.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too, very much so. It's a great industry and it's a great thing. The bicycle, it still excites me every day. You know, it's just a cool thing,
yeah.
Bicycles.
Yes, it is.
So I think we're going to say thank you very much, Ben Serrata. It has just been a delight, as usual.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And I'll see you next time.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So that's our show for tonight. I'll be back next week with our regular 5:30 broadcast, and then the podcast will be at 6:30. We will have a book review as well as my interviews from Interbike. Happy autumn. Happy riding. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.